I think it might be helpful for the UK to consider towing icebergs down from the Arctic.
Can you give listeners a visual of what it is to tow an iceberg down into the West?
No, because it's comical. It's comical at face value.
I'm Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capisani.
You're listening to A Hostile Climate. Simo, what are we talking about today?
Alex, today we're going to talk about scarcity.
Scarcity? When there isn't enough.
Correct.
What isn't there enough of?
Well, one thing increasingly, as a Californian and a Los Angelino, that there seems to not be enough of is water.
Yeah.
Or at least something that I've been hearing my whole life there's not enough of.
I remember when I was a kid, there were these, and I grew up in Massachusetts where, like, it's not a water-stressed environment, but there were these ads on the TV that it would be like a kid brushing their teeth and the faucet was on. And then it was a split screen. And on the other side, there was like a fish in a fish tank, and the water in the fish's home would just drop as the faucet was left on. And the whole lesson was turn off the faucet while you're brushing your teeth so that the fish doesn't run out of water.
Oh, yeah.
That's like burned in my mind, even growing up in a wet environment.
See, what's so interesting is that you had it connected to fish. We just literally had, you know, growing up in L.A., it was, if it's yellow, leave it mellow. So we just literally knew not to flush the toilet. And that practice, to my wife's chagrin, continued throughout my life. Maybe that's TMI.
Yeah, there you go, folks.
Yeah. Or the shower with a friend. Or making sure that we were having our sprinklers on, you know, timers. And then just literally shutting everything off and letting everything die in the summers.
So why is this all a climate change issue? Why are we talking about scarcity in light of climate change?
Well, there's lots of things that climate change is accelerating or making worse. Water scarcity is an issue in and of itself, given the different ways that we're reusing or not using properly water. But climate change is also an accelerator when it comes to water vulnerability for many communities. And just to kind of, I don't know, maybe give a 2-second background, but there's over 2 billion people in the world already that are relatively vulnerable because they don't have access to fresh drinking water. And this is a problem that will just continue.
Yeah. And as we talk about global environmental change at sort of the biggest level, one of the things that comes up again and again and again is how we're running out of stuff, right? And it's not just water. Water is sort of one of these examples, but resources in general that are non-renewable. We see this clock ticking down slowly where it feels like, okay, there's a finite amount of stuff and we just don't have enough. And what do we do when we don't have enough?
We're the fish in that fish tank from the commercial, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're the fish in the fish tank. And we go like, uh-oh, what's going to happen here as we run out?
So this just raises a number of questions about to what extent we can understand climate change as a resource problem itself.
Sure.
And then the knock-on effects, right, about climate change and its impacts on resources. Maybe it just makes sense to just try to be really explicit about what we mean by a common pool resource first.
Sure.
Which it's just, a set. It could be natural, right? Or it can be a human-made resource system. But it's kind of defined by two major characteristics.
Yep.
You know, the first is that it has this element of subtractibility. So basically, you harvesting a resource subtracts from my ability to do the same, potentially.
So just on that note, it may be renewable,
yeah,
but it takes a long time, right?
Exactly.
So it is reducible.
Reducible and subtractable, right? So in its reducibility, you using it can compromise my ability to use it. And I guess a second major issue, which, you know, has both of these have a kind of normativity to them. The second issue is just that it lends itself, common pool resources, to be at risk of free riding, which just means that some individuals or groups, right, could gain benefits from using the resource without having to contribute anything to that resource upkeep. So that's really what makes these common pool resources vulnerable to a type of overuse and a potential exploitation of them.
Yes. I mean, we could think of these common pool resources these common pool resource problems are in one sense a problem of our collective action. So sometimes we call those collective action problems, but that just means that collectively together, we create some emergent problem, right? It's not about any one person using too much water. It's about, well, together, all of us use water and it ends up over allocating the resource. And there's a few ways that we might try to solve that, that are sort of different approaches to understanding not just the solution, but also the problem, right? So we could think of it as a rights problem, or we could think of it as a coordination problem, to use sort of two lenses. For us, we're genuinely confused on the best way to understand these problems, or at least I am, right? I really do think that, sure, there is this real challenge of what do you do when there isn't enough of something? What do you do? And these are all different approaches to try to answer that. And I don't know which one's right. That's the fun of this conversation.
Do you want to lay out the two? So you were starting to talk about rights.
Yeah, sure. I'll lay out sort of two big pictures. So at least in the US, historically, we have solved a lot of common pool resource problems through divvying up rights to those resources. And actually, there's a well-known political philosopher embedded in sort of the roots of our democracy, John Locke, a 17th century British philosopher, was extremely influential to our founding fathers and in the creation of our system of government and our laws. And Locke had this sort of famous, what's called the Lockean proviso. It's among my favorite provisos.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm a big proviso guy, and so was Locke.
this is an Easter egg for those of you that listen.
I can't
to the
think
comp
of another
episode.
Proviso. If anyone has another proviso out there, let me know. Okay.
So the Locke proviso is your favorite because it's the only one.
Yeah, exactly. So Locke has this proviso on how legitimate ownership and legitimate rights come about. So first, Locke thinks that, well, the way we can understand rights to resources is really simple. It's a mixture between your labor and land. If you mix your labor with some raw material, well, then that's how you come to own it. So if you gather a bunch of iron ore and turn it into a sword, you own the sword. And he just sort of extends that out to the land itself and resources in the land. Mixing your labor with the resources is how you come to own it. And he says, but hang on a second. This is the proviso. Hang on a second. It's only the case that you can maintain a legitimate claim so long as there's, he says, enough and as good remaining for others, so long as it doesn't prevent others from similarly pursuing their claims. So this kind of proviso on legitimate rights assumes that there is enough. So when we divvy up rights over something like water, Locke gives us a system for understanding what might be fair or what might be sort of a legacy system. But the guidance stops once we hit these problems of over allocation, once there is once there are more rights than there is water, or once there just isn't enough of a given resource for everyone to pursue their own claims. And so there's a real problem there where we have systems of rights where we've divvied up natural resources, but the tank that we've divvied up is getting smaller. And as the climate warms and as these systems get stressed, we have competing claims that are mutually exclusive, or at least that's the worry. So that's sort of one approach to looking at it. And the way that seeks to solve these problems is by saying, well, your right is a claim against everybody else that excludes them from your little bit of the resource. And in exchange, you exclude yourself from their little bit of the resource. And it sort of tidies up the issue.
Some folks actually interpret the sort of like Lockean mechanism as rather that there's common ownership over all those resources. And so the world is actually owned in that kind of raw value sense in an egalitarian way. Yeah, exactly. And so that private acquisition is the thing that has to be constrained or has to be justified in virtue of certain kinds of egalitarian principles. So not to go too far into it, but I think there's always a tendency to read it, you know, in the kind of like maybe right-leaning libertarian way instead of the left-leaning libertarian way. But this common ownership of the earth is also another way to think about what that like predetermined, you know, external space is before we start mucking about it. So I thought just to throw that out there.
But I think the real point of this approach is, well, maybe this is, I'll just share how I think of this approach.
Yeah, yeah.
This approach sort of understands rights sort of like a technology. It's a claim held against everybody else to produce a certain outcome of efficiency. Right. It's a claim that I hold that everyone else has to respect that cleanly tries to solve this coordination problem. But there's also some work out there that suggests we don't need this at all. There's other ways we can cooperate where we can hold something in common and maintain it in common through strict cooperation. So famously, the Nobel Prize winning economist Eleanor Ostrom observes this in pastoral communities in East Africa, working together towards common ends. And the idea is that if you have really strong community ties and social norms in place, then that can work as a institutional check within a community where everyone can benefit from cooperation directly.
Exactly. So Ostrom is challenging this notion that there's a type of inevitability that common pool resource is going to be drained because of people acting out of self-interest and in that kind of, you know, zero-sum way. And, fun fact in preparing for this episode that I did not know was that her dissertation that she was doing back in 1965.
Was her dissertation governing the commons?
Yeah, so it was specifically looking at groundwater use in Los Angeles, where she was from. And she argued that water basin management, a better water basin management program that was more cooperative would actually lead to long-term efficient use of the water resources in SoCal. And then she goes off to do all the stuff that she becomes famous with. But she starts in LA about water.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, I did not.
It all comes
either.
Back to water.
It's coming back to water. But I will say, real quickly on that, and like what she then ends up developing is that, you know, she might have started in LA and really wanted to study how communities found ways of preserving and managing these shared resources. And she does highlight, right, a series of ways to do so successfully. So maybe we can get into talking about those a little bit, but.
Sure. And I think the challenge for the sort of direct cooperation approaches are, and maybe some folks are sort of seeing this on the horizon, cooperation gets harder the bigger the community, right?
Or the more undefined the community is.
Or the more undefined, exactly. So if the border of the community is not clear where membership falls, or if the community is too large, say the 150 million people that live, you know, in the Western U.S., it gets harder and harder to engage in that kind of cooperation. Ostrom does actually suggest that there may be a numbers limit on coordination of this kind, where when a community reaches a certain size, it becomes harder and harder. It becomes too easy to free ride, and it becomes harder to engage. And then the other challenge is that when you have competing communities, you have a sort of compound challenge of coordination. If it's not between individuals, but now it's between Arizona and California and Colorado and New Mexico, right? And Nevada, you have in Utah, the Colorado River Basin states, you have this sort of completely separate challenge where it's not individual human actors trying to cooperate, but rather it's institutions trying to cooperate. So it may be that we need both of these solutions. We need them at different scales for different parts of the problem.
And in part, like you were saying, you get these sort of also the potential competing claims to things or competing communities. And that's why she specifically pinpoints why you need a fair process for conflict resolution. So she's not saying conflict's not going to happen, right, as she's mapping out these kinds of cooperative schemes, but rather identifies that all those participants that might be competing also need to have buy-in to the process that would help to adjudicate any conflicts that would happen. And a way also to punish bad actors and cheaters.
Yeah, you need enforcement too, right?
There is.
At least in her examples, enforcement is often through social systems. With a rights-based system, enforcement is our legal system. It's, well, if someone has a right, they have a claim within our legal system to whatever that right provides them. That becomes important.
Yeah.
So I think we should run with this water thing.
Yeah.
Because I used to live in Colorado. I'm worried about water in the West,
too. I'm from LA. Eleanor's from LA. She was worried about it.
So for Eleanor, for Eleanor, hey. My daughter's name is Eleanor.
After
so
Ostrom?
Everything I do is for Anne Eleanor.
Yeah.
So let's do this. Let's try to talk to a few folks who know more than we do about water in the West and see how they think scarcity plays out and what some solutions might be. Okay, so I think we should check in with a friend of mine. John Bergeron is the regional policy manager for Western Resource Advocates. John did his PhD on managing water in the West, specifically on the Colorado River, and he continues to work on water policy in the West. And I want to hear what he has to say about how our institutions are trying to manage this problem of scarcity.
That sounds good. Let's jump in.
So we'll tell all our listeners, I used to live in John's house briefly. I believe your daughter's room used to be my room.
Yep.
So funny.
So we've had children in that room for many, many years.
Yep. Yeah. So not that much has changed.
That's hilarious. Was that when you were doing your PhD?
Yes. So we were both there at the same time.
We started at the same time, but I think you finished like years ahead of me.
Probably, John. I mean, that makes sense, right?
You know, a lot of people go to school for 8 years, Alex. Something wrong with taking 8 years to do a PhD, okay?
Nothing. There's nothing wrong with that.
That's the normal time, honestly.
Well, let's just jump in. So you study water in the West.
I did study water in the West, yeah.
And you're also a fisherman.
Ostensibly, ever since the birth of our daughter 2.5 years ago, I think I've gone like 4 times.
Well, as someone who cares about fish and cares about water, what do you wish people would know about water in the West that is usually left out?
I think what is usually left out is how connected we are here in the West through our water. People hear water and they either think, oh, that's the stuff that just comes out of my tap, and I turn on my tap and it comes out and I don't have to think twice about it other than when I pay my monthly bill. I'm a little annoyed at how much it is, although are you really? It's way cheaper than it should be. So most people think about it in that way, or they think about, oh, water is what I turn my sprinkler on and I water my lawn and I get a nice green grass and it's really nice. And that's what water is to me. Or water is something I hear about. Water is something like I hear that climate change and water is bad. I hear that there's a crisis in the West, but I don't know much about it. And what I think is important is how integrated water is into everything we do here in the West, from our livelihoods to our culture to our recreation to our food to our energy to our tribal communities. I mean, water is just essential to everything we do. And it's more than just a tap. It's more than just a sprinkler. It's more than just a reservoir. It's more than just a canal. It's what integrates everything we do here in the West. And if not for a healthy, thriving water ecosystem, I worry that we would have a much different society here in the West.
Do you find that message, and presumably that's a message that you're hoping to continue to deliver when you're talking to people, do you feel like people are a little bit more inclined towards that in light of a general awareness around climate change, or at least around the concept of water being threatened within the context of climate? Or is water still kind of left out of the climate zeitgeist when you're interacting with people?
There's a bit of a disconnect because there was some really interesting polling here in Colorado, or I guess around the West a year or two ago, you know, that asked general public audience of what they think about water and climate change and what we should do about it. And I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it was, you know, 70-80% of people thought water is a serious concern and we need to do more. We need to conserve. We need to work with our neighbor states. We need to work with the federal government. We need to find ways to use less water. Like, there's general support for that. And I don't think that is necessarily controversial. And then a lot of people will say, well, oh, so you just think I have to take shorter showers, or I have to like not flush the toilet, and that's the big disconnect, I think, is when we're talking about climate change and water in the West, individual behavior is important. And I think everyone should do their part, but where you're going to have systematic transformative change to really address the challenge of climate change in water in the West is policy. and finding ways across the state level, at the federal level, at the international level, finding ways to use less water. And so that's the disconnect, I think, is people, yes, agree we need to use less water. But then when it comes to our decision makers crafting policy around how to use less water, there's less of that urgency. There's more hesitancy to think about that big system scale change.
Well, so I see a potential for an opportunity in that, because while the idea of reforming water policy sounds like a heavy lift, the fact that people agree that water is an important issue, that we need to conserve water, you said 80% of people polled in the West, that's way more than agree on climate action. So is there this in through water where, because it's sort of separate from the climate issue, maybe it's less political, more bipartisan, easier to sort of move ahead on than other climate? And maybe I'm going to add a hard question to that, which is, I want your thoughts on that. But then maybe we could take a step back and you could give us like the 5-minute, like 30,000 foot history of water policy in the West. Just to kind of let folks know where we're at. And we're out over our skis here, right? Like Simone and I, we drink water, right?
I actually have like a tremendous amount of like built in anxiety around water. So this is like close to my heart. I mean, I literally carry, the listeners can't see, but like I carry a massive jug of drinking water with me everywhere. And now I'm in the UK where it's raining all the time. And people literally make fun of me. Like, are you worried somehow that you're not going to have access to fresh drinking water wherever you're going? So I was going to say, I'm out over my skis, maybe with respect to policy, but
so climate anxiety is welded into your soul, though.
With respect to water.
With water, yeah.
With water, yeah. In particular, from being from LA.
Simone, my wife and I were in the UK this summer, and we were in central Scotland. We ended up doing a little walk, and we ran into a local guy, and I was talking to him and asking, he asked what I did and asked what he did, and we just started talking about water, and I said, oh, so you guys have plenty of water here in Scotland, right? And he was like, no, actually, last year we had some of the lowest runoff ever, and we were facing severe watering restrictions just last fall.
Yeah, this summer is big time for that too.
Well, I want to circle back to my question in a minute, but I think it's fascinating where water stress is actually a lot more pervasive than we think. Here in Alaska, I mean, I live 20 miles from the temperate rainforest. There's tons of water. And yet one of the most controversial power installations where I live is called the Aklutna Dam. It's a big hydro project originally built in the 1920s. It's been around for 100 years. The power plant there now is about 70 years old. And there's this big effort to restore the Aklutna River and the salmon run in the Aklutna River. And a lot of opponents to restoration say, like, well, it's our cheapest energy source and we really need that, and it's part of our renewable portfolio. But at the same time, the water levels in the lake are so low that it never runs at capacity. The power plant never runs at capacity. And it while it could make up 10 or 15% of our energy portfolio, it only makes up in practice 1 to 2% of our energy portfolio. And even in such a wet place, because of glacial recession and just inconsistent rainfall and runoff and inconsistent outflow, it isn't the sort of hydro dream that it used to be. So I think these issues have sort of lessons even in really wet places.
I was going to say, it's a bit of a paradox, right? Like in the UK, like you were saying, John, in Scotland, I'm in the northeast, you know, of the country. So I'm right at the border of Scotland. And, you know, since I've moved here, I feel like it's rained every single day. When like rain was an event, right, for me in LA, like it was an event. Here, people are just so casual about it, and it's just part of what it is. And so I can't possibly conceive of how we're now looking at a drought this summer, and they're talking about it. And the reason in part is because of improper storage. So just to put a point, like that's actually very similar to an issue that's happening in Southern California, where you're going to see these kinds of boom and bust cycles of drought and then El Nino conditions, but we don't have proper infrastructure to actually deal with water storage and collection to then see us out through times of drought. And it just boggles my mind that the same or similar issues like that in LA are also the same things that I'm experiencing here when it literally rains every single day. So I think like this water paradox about infrastructure and storage and frequency and availability, it doesn't have to just be in deserts.
You know, there's been proposals here in the West for how to augment the water supply and bring more water in to deal with drought and everything. And given what Alex just mentioned and what you just mentioned, I think it might be helpful for the UK to consider towing icebergs down from the Arctic and using that as a water supply, because that was actually studied here in the West.
Yep.
And towing icebergs down from Alaska, you lose like 90% of the iceberg to melt, but 10% of a giant iceberg is a lot of water still. And so
it's a lot of water.
What? How does that? Can you give listeners a visual of what it is to tow an iceberg?
No, because it's comical. It's comical at face value. Okay. I mean, there's plenty of studies about how to augment the water supply. That's kind of one of the more outlandish ones. But, you know, desalination, new pipelines, those things are actually considered in the mix.
Is there an opportunity in resource scarcity that's less political than climate change? So people agree that we need to conserve water. They agree that there are issues with our water system and our water policy. Does that mean there's sort of an easier path to action there than to a sort of bigger picture issue like climate change and climate policy?
Yes and no. So there's been studies on effective education and outreach around water conservation, and in general, people trust their water providers. They think their water providers are looking out for them, and they're going to be able to supply water, and they're conservative, lowercase c conservative organizations. You know, they're not responding to or trying new things willy nilly. They're actually like, they have a mission of delivering reliable drinking water, and that's what they do. And so therefore we trust them. And so there's a way to communicate around climate change through your water provider, because that is a trusted resource. And the water provider can say, these are the impacts we're actually seeing. Like, you can talk about what the cause of climate change all you want, but like, our snowpack has been running off 2 weeks earlier in the last few years, and our soil moisture is dried out, and we see increasing demands because of warmer summers. We see these impacts to rivers in the late summer because they get so low and so warm that we see big fish kills and that sort of thing. So they can say objectively, here's what we're seeing. So there is an opportunity. But I say yes and no, because there's an opportunity for kind of that individual education around what climate change means for water. But when you get to policy, water is just like climate, where values are so embedded in the conversation that information doesn't necessarily change someone's opinion. And same thing with water. Is water is people's livelihoods. People have generational connections to water. They're how they view water is really wrapped up in their values and how they view the world more broadly. And so when you talk about transformative change and we need to use millions of acre feet of less water in the Colorado River Basin, people immediately say, wait, what does that mean for my livelihood? Does that mean I can no longer farm? Does that mean I have to move away? Does that mean my kids can't grow up here? Does that mean X, Y, and Z? And so there is an in, but it's because everything is so value-laden in the water world, just as it is in climate, it's difficult to make those big inroads at that broader basin scale.
Okay. So I think that's so interesting, and I think that's where we should dive in. But I want to understand how we got here. So could you give us the sort of, again, that 30,000-foot overview of where we're at with water in the West and how we got here?
White men appropriated water supplies and used it to grow alfalfa.
That was really, that was, that's, I,
do you want to give a year? What time are we talking about? Westward expansion?
So yeah, when you're talking about the Colorado River specifically, the development of the river began in 1922 when the seven U.S. basin states met to begin to allocate the river between the basin states. And since 1922, throughout the 20th century, there were numerous agreements and treaties and acts and court decrees and court decisions and administrative rulings that further divvied up the Colorado River to the point now where Mexico has an allocation that they get every year. The seven U.S. states have an allocation they get every year. The lower basin states have a fixed quantity of water, so they get an actual acre foot of water per year. The upper basin states get a proportion of what's available. And so that's kind of where things stand. But importantly, and what's pretty universally known, is that century of development around the river and policy and how we allocate it. It going back to 1922, the river was overallocated pretty clearly. You look at some of the science around estimating the river's flow in the early 20th century, and what the negotiators were saying in 1922 does not line up with what a broader scientific understanding of how much water was actually available. And then we've just seen that over and over, and that finally came to a head in the early 2000s when the 2002 drought hit and our major reservoirs like Powell and Lake Mead started plummeting. People realized, yes, we've over-appropriated the river. There's more allocated on paper than it's available. And climate change has really impacted this basin. One of my colleagues I work with has said that climate change has come barging through the doors of the Colorado River Basin. And so since that drought, we've been trying to find ways to share more shortages, to use less water, to deal with crashing reservoirs. We've updated policies. We've come up with new, both mandated and volunteer programs to use less water. And right now we're in the context of renegotiating a whole set of guidelines to manage the river. So starting in 2026, we'll have those new guidelines, and those will manage the river for another 20 plus years. And hopefully they are actually account for climate change impacts over allocation and can resemble a sustainable use of the Colorado River. How tribes play into the conversation is incredibly important, and that is often historically they've been excluded from these conversations and these negotiations. But more recently, it's gotten better. There was hope with these new guidelines that they would have a seat at the actual table. It's unclear if that's really happening, but there's definitely more recognition of the importance of tribal water rights and how those water rights can fit into a sustainable Colorado River. For some, it's going to be using more water. Like, that's a fundamental fact that there are people, some tribes in the West don't have infrastructure for drinking water. And we're going to have to find ways to build that infrastructure and bring those tribes water. So that's more water. So it just means that the rest of the basin has to find ways to be even more efficient, because we have to increase water supplies in some areas for some of the tribes that have their water rights settled and supplied. So that's a big component that I think is important to consider. And I'm hopeful that I'm not going to speak for the tribes, but like, it seems like it's moving in a good direction, although it's unclear exactly where that will land.
That's positive to hear. I mean, hopefully the Just Transitions framework, right, provides that platform to show that it's not necessarily cuts across the board, but rather just redistributing in a more just way these resources, and to compensate to some extent for unjust redistribution of the past. So that's super helpful. Before because I'm curious to find out what is in those guidelines and who was party to establishing them. But do you think you could say a little bit more about specifics about how climate change continues to stress the system? When you were saying it barges through the door, what have those impacts been? Given that the river was always going to be overstretched, how is climate adding into the mix?
So what climate change has done has forced a reckoning on the basin that probably wouldn't have happened for another several decades, right? Because the overallocation, as as cities grow and as more people move to the West, we become more water efficient, and so we find ways to grow without using more water. But in general, an overappropriated river would come to a head at some point, and you'd have to find ways to use less water. What climate change has done is, because the Colorado River is a snow pack driven system. So in other words, most of the water for the Colorado River comes from snowpack in the Rocky Mountains. It's quite sensitive to temperature changes. And we've seen a pretty consistent temperature increase in the Colorado River Basin the last couple of decades, which has led to things like the snowpack will melt off sooner, which not only affects the timing of everything, but actually it consumes more water because it lengthens the growing season. So if you have water, snow melting off sooner, the vegetation, soil, all those ecosystems absorb or transpire that water earlier. So you actually lose less water. Less water makes it to the rivers itself. And so you have those impacts on the supply side of things, and whereas snowmelt changes, more precipitation is falling as rain as opposed to snow. And then you also have demand changes because it's warmer, it's hotter. Crops require more water. People end up, you know, watering their lawns more. And so you see that increase in demand as well. And so there's a famous Bureau of Reclamation chart that showed big picture supply and demand over the last 100 years. And you see right around the turn of the century, of the 21st century, those lines crossed. And we started to see demand being outweighing supply. And since then, it's only gotten worse. And with climate change, it's expected to get even worse. And so that's what we're seeing, is a reduced supply, increased demand, leading to less water being available in the system.
When we think about sort of that over allocation and that increased climate stress, who are the big users? Because so you said before that personal behavior matters, but that we need policy change, right? So if we think about sort of household use, industrial use, agriculture, all the big uses, how does it break down in the Colorado River Basin?
The largest users by far is agriculture. Depending on where you are, it's 70-80% of the river's of human uses of the river goes to irrigated agriculture. The majority of that goes to irrigating alfalfa and other hays for livestock feed. And so that's the biggest user by far. And within that, in the upper basin, there's a good amount of agricultural use, although because of the climate and the elevation, there's less water used for ag in the upper basin. In the lower basin, places like Southern California, Central California, Central Arizona, those are really large agricultural districts. There's a if you eat leafy greens in the United States in the wintertime, there's a almost certain chance that those leafy greens were grown with Colorado River water. So it's ingrained to our food supply. Although, like I said, a lot goes to cattle feed. And so, that's something to think about, is how much we're draining a river dry, like for dairy and beef.
So I want to know if I'm thinking about this wrong, because so we have this huge scarcity issue with this fundamental element of our lives, water, that we know we need. We know that some of that is a historical problem of allocation, but that there is decreasing supply because of climate change in the rivers. And yet those lower basin states that you're talking about are largely desert climate. It's arid or semi-arid climate. Why are we irrigating the desert when we don't have enough water?
Are you asking why Vegas exists? or
maybe that's yeah. That's one example, but even just yeah. from the ag standpoint, why am I buying lettuce from Arizona right now?
There's a couple of ways to think about that, and this is interesting. Bringing up Vegas, let's put that aside, because I actually think Vegas is a model of water conservation, and if every city in the West did what Vegas has done, our cities would be very resilient, much better place, be using a lot less water. Huh. So people love to beat up on Vegas, but I really wish every city in the West would do what Vegas has done. They're leaders when it comes to using less water.
Well, wait. Let's hear about that for a second. What does Vegas do? What is the lesson there?
They've been forced to really focus on water conservation because 90% of their water supply comes from the Colorado River, and that is from Lake Mead. And literally, their 90% of their city's drinking water straws are in Lake Mead. And if Lake Mead came down low enough, and that would call into question whether or not they could actually supply water, that's a big deal. Like, you're talking about cutting off water to a major city. So they have been forced to think about water conservation. Side note, they also built a $1 billion additional straw to the very bottom of Lake Mead. So even if Lake Mead gets really low, they can always get water out. But so they've been leaders on just general indoor conservation, and then real leaders on outdoor conservation. They developed one of the first really robust turf replacement programs, which incentivized people to rip up their bluegrass and replace it with water efficient landscaping or native landscaping. So they've done a lot on the incentive side. They've put a lot of money into helping people reduce their outdoor use. But then more progressively, they've really focused on the regulatory side. And they put great limits on what you can install in new development. So you always see like these gifts of like the Vegas metropolitan region growing out and out and out. Yes, that's happened, but they've been really intentional in making sure that that growth does not use much more water other than a little bit of indoor use. And so they actually, and then the more recently, just as 2 years ago, I think it was, they adopted it was a statewide piece of legislation, but focused on the Vegas area, that banned what they call non-functional turf in all development, in existing development as well. So they said by 2025 or 2026, we have to go in and rip out all this turf that no one uses because it uses a lot of water and we don't use it. So, and then you get things like their big fancy casinos and hotels, like the one that sprays all the water, that's all recycled water from their hotels. So both on the indoor and outdoor side, they have been models of what it can mean for a desert community to grow and thrive. I mean, no one would say that the Las Vegas economy is crashing or, yeah. And just one more example, and it's probably getting way too in the details, but they just held, Las Vegas just held a Formula One race, and they're part of like the Formula One circuit now or whatever that's called. And in partnership with the people who put on Formula One, they wanted that to be a net zero water consumption event. So they did like part of the course was on the streets. And so they had to clean the streets before the race cars could actually do it. So that's a lot of water. So they build these, I forget the exact name of them, but they basically take the condensation from all the water cooling towers in the hotels and turn that condensation into water. Whoa. And that's what they use to clean the street ahead of the races.
So it's like, not gray water per se. It's literally condensation.
It's condensation. They built up enough tanks of this condensated water over time that they could clean the streets ahead of the race. So they weren't using new potable water supply. So that's why I say, like, if every city did what Vegas is doing, I think our cities would be in a much better spot in the West.
Efficiency and innovation can actually increase your effective supply.
With proper incentives and enabling
individual
scale and large scale to be able to do it.
And why I think it's in the regulatory side too, not just saying here's some money to, if you want to volunteer to replace your turf, it's saying, no, here are the rules. You can't put this turf in because we don't, as a city, we don't want to waste our water on that. And so I think that's to me, that's where more cities need to go. And more cities have moved in that direction.
Setting collective values, right? That's saying as a community that you're going to prioritize a certain value structure so that you can continue to grow in the most sustainable way possible.
But you're doing that with carrots and sticks, which I think is really interesting, given that a lot of federal policy when it comes to climate is mostly carrots. And they've been very, very hesitant to use sticks. Right. So I think this is an interesting insight in general about effectiveness of certain kinds of climate transition questions. But
well, let's talk about those water rights a little bit. Am I correct that I don't know if it's all or most Colorado River water rights are use it or lose it water rights?
Every state is slightly different, but in general, the Colorado River states use prior appropriation, which in general is if you don't use your whole water right, you lose it. Some states have started to pull that back a little bit and like finding ways to allow for farmers to use less water, but not lose their water right. So we're kind of moving in a better direction.
So that seems like historically, at least, a perverse incentive, right? To use, use more water. That's not the only one of these perverse incentives to use more water. Okay. I'm trying to be as delicate as I can. How do we practically move from that kind of sort of historic approach where we have these perverse incentives, like a right that if you don't use more water, you then can't use it again in the future, to that sort of Vegas model where efficiency is the not just priority, but the sort of guiding value of development, of use, and our sort of our water system as a whole? I'm hoping this is in the next round of guidelines, right? Like, this is something that I imagine is something you're thinking about as these guidelines come out.
There's a lot there. So what's coming out of these new guidelines is, and this has been acknowledged by both the upper and lower basin states, is we need to use less water. that's kind of a how much less we use and who uses it and how you pay for it and where it is and all that. That's those are the big sticking points, and that's where all the challenges are.
Can I just ask a clarificatory question on that really quick? So these are the sure. states making these commitments, but within the context of the states, do you have like, you know, self-determining communities like Native communities having a particular sort of commitment, municipalities, like does it cut up in more defined ways that then just gets put out as like a larger state commitment or obligation?
So this is one of the biggest challenges with the interstate negotiations for the Colorado River is the people who do the negotiations. There's these, each state has a representative. It's a governor appointed representative, and they'll go out with and negotiate with the other six states and say, here's what we're willing to do. And they all in general get it. They all know they need to use less water, but the challenge is Arizona might agree to using 1 million acre feet less water. Now that person has to go back to Arizona and say, to the irrigation districts, the agricultural districts, the cities, the all the agencies, and say, hey, we have to use less water. Now we have to figure out how to do it. And that's where the challenge is there are some places where you can kind of do mandated charges. The Bureau of Reclamation, the federal government, has pretty significant authorities in the lower basin. They could just cut people off.
Is that through the big dams, through Lake Powell and Lake Mead, that they can?
Yeah, like, so in the lower basin states, the Secretary of the Interior is what's called the water master, which basically means that secretary has authority to deliver and not deliver water in the lower basin. So they could, it hasn't been tested, but on paper, Secretary Holland could say, hey, lower basin states, you are all shorted 50%, and then she could do that. She would get sued.
So she's got her hand on the faucet.
The lawsuits would like knock her down. So like the lawsuits would come in full force. But so that's the challenge is like, how do we actually implement these shortages on the ground, and who's going to pay for it? And I think, Alex, to your earlier question, it's really easy to say like, why are we growing cattle feed in the West? Why are we growing leafy greens in the West? And I think that's a valid conversation, but then there's also, like we said earlier, these are people's livelihoods. These are people's values. They've been farming for generations. They built these farms under a promise from the federal government to supply water. And so I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just saying that's their viewpoint is like, this is who we are, which, but we need to use less water, and agriculture uses the majority of water. So that's in the connection to climate change, I think there could be an opportunity. There's been discussion in some coal communities about getting these entire communities that are built on mining coal. How do you help them move away from that? And then so there's this idea of offices of just transition. Like, let's help these communities move away from their historic livelihoods. I think that maybe that's what we need here in the West. And I don't think it's not all or nothing. It's not, we have no agriculture. We just need to use less water in agriculture, and we can find ways to help those communities still farm, still have thriving economies that, you know, they're able to have the livelihoods that they've had,
yeah.
But they're using less water.
If sustainability is the path to continuing that livelihood, then that's going to be a really shared value and another in, right? And so if some of those policy changes like a use it or lose it right shift to incentivizing using less water, maybe that just means updating our agricultural systems and sort of modernizing them to use less, which I imagine there's actually a lot of opportunity in.
I mean, so this is what I was going to have a question about, and just from a little bit of familiarity with, you know, the kind of big debates that have been happening in Southern California, it's not just about updating agricultural practices, but is it also incentivizing shifts towards different kinds of ag? So like when you're talking about just transition and it's, you know, compensating formerly fossil fuel communities to move towards some other, you know, type of energy system, is it similar in this case with agriculture, like moving away from growing feed or reducing growing nuts, which are, you know, almonds are incredibly water intensive, and moving towards a different kind of crop? Because I know there's tensions usually with farmers about like, it's simply not just converting over that's necessarily easy. So have you kind of been privy to any of those kinds of conversations yet about what that looks like.
Yeah, so there are plenty of things that farmers can do to use less water and still be productive and have a productive farming livelihood. It's not as simple. You hear a lot of people saying, well, it's all flood irrigated alfalfa fields. Let's just switch that flood irrigation to drip irrigation and problem solved. With irrigation technology, it's not that simple. And like what we've seen is if you just switching to drip doesn't necessarily save water. In some cases, it can actually use more water. And in every case, the flood irrigation return flows that come back to the rivers because of the inefficiencies actually do, they supply water for those rivers downstream. And so like there's these weird things about just simply changing the technology doesn't always work. In some cases, it can actually make things worse. But there are plenty of things like crop shifting. So what you were saying, Simona, like if you change the types of crops you grow, those can use less water. Alfalfa is incredibly water intensive, and there's crops that require less water. There's things like reduced deficit irrigation, which is basically if you're growing alfalfa in the Southwest and down in Arizona, that alfalfa, if you want it to be like perfectly green and like able to harvest pretty regularly, you have to water it a lot more in like July and August when things are super hot to get that productivity. But what people have found is it's so hot that like you don't actually get a lot of productivity from adding that much more water. So in those really hot months, just use way less water. That's called reduced deficit irrigation. You don't lose much value because the crops are not growing much anyway. And then you use less water overall. So those are just examples of ways that we can be more water efficient in our agricultural sector. There are many things that Alex has highlighted, like with water rights, but like I said, states are trying to move in a better direction to allow the policy environment to allow those farmers to innovate and do those new things to use less water.
What are some of the things like that you're hoping to see in these new Colorado River guidelines? Are there any like specifics that you're like best case hope are adopted?
So there's a group of us, conservation groups that we just submitted our idea to the Bureau of Reclamation last week. And there's a lot to it. There's one thing I wanted to highlight, which is it doesn't get into the details of like how to conserve water, but it would create a program to allow water users in the lower basin states to conserve water, to find ways to use less, like we've been talking about. And then they wouldn't lose that water. They could actually store that water in Lake Powell or Lake Mead. And while that water is being stored, the Bureau of Reclamation could use it for environmental purposes. So they could basically shepherd this water. They could release it from Lake Powell, do a high flow experiment through the Grand Canyon, which mimics kind of historical pre-dam hydrology. They could use it to benefit native fish. They could use it in ways to reduce non-native fish populations. And then they would go down and end up in Lake Mead. And then the way the program works is they could then shepherd that water back up to Lake Powell and then continually use it for environmental purposes. And then if whatever user created that water, if they want it at a later date, they could get that water back. So basically, if all users are participating, you're building up this bank of water, this reserve of water, and it can be used for these environmental benefits. And then if individual users want to pull some of their water out, they can. So that's kind of the more innovative program we would like to see in the new guidelines. And then so it's just for lower basin users in Lake Powell, Lake Mead. But as we highlight in our proposal, it could be expanded basin wide. And you could envision users across the basin, both in US and Mexico, finding ways to use less water. And then because the program gives Reclamation this flexibility to move that water wherever, you could see that water being moved and used for environmental purposes wherever it's needed. So that's one of the things we're hoping to see in these new guidelines is a more innovative, flexible approach to incentivize users to use less water and then take advantage of that conserved water for explicit environmental benefits.
Does that kind of benefit sharing then jettison the issue of seniority water rights? Because I know like California, right, has certain kinds of claims where then if there is, you know, cuts to be made, you see Arizona or Nevada, you know, losing out. Is that at this point then jettison given this kind of more flexible model or?
So the reserve I was talking about would work within that whatever. So you're right to point out that there are priorities and California does have seniority over Arizona. And if push came to shove, push came to shove, California could say, we're not going to do a drop of conservation until Arizona has no Colorado River water supply. They could say that legally. They're not. And so part of the new guidelines, though, are they're all the basin states are trying to find voluntary amounts of water that they're willing to conserve. So California is saying we're going to conserve X number of acre feet. Arizona is saying we'll take this number of shortages. Nevada is saying we'll take this number of shortages as well. So they're kind of working within that, within the long history of the law of the river to come up with their voluntary numbers, but they would be, you know, mandated within each of their states. So they're working within that seniority system.
I mean, that's a hopeful thing, right? That's an example of collaboration and sort of, you know, not creating a kind of zero sum game between commitments. I don't know. Am I being overly optimistic?
Like I said, California doesn't have to do anything until Arizona has completely lost their supply. So I think it's encouraging. There's still plenty of disagreement between the lower basin states, between the upper basin states, between Mexico. And so everyone still is jostling and kind of flexing their political and legal muscles to try and maximize their future Colorado River supply.
What are some of the other arenas where you're seeing this play out? So here's this sort of state level negotiation. Are there say like market based solutions that are also being pushed by individual states or sectors to try to conserve water and address issues of scarcity? Are there federal, state, or local education programs that you think are successful? Are there practices that are sort of within industry that you see paths forward in? Because it seems like we need many scales of action and sort of many tentacles to tackle something like this.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, there are plenty of things that local communities can do, that states can do, that the feds can do, and that we as a region can do. So there are various programs in place to try and incentivize users to use less water. In the upper basin, there's been what's called the System Conservation Pilot Program last couple of years, which pays users to temporarily use less water. And so that program has been growing over the years. There's a lower basin program called Intentionally Created Surplus, which allows users to conserve water and they bank it in Lake Mead, and then those users can get that water back. The Inflation Reduction Act, the Biden administration signed into law a couple of years ago, infused a huge amount of money into the basin, something like $4 billion. And so there's been ongoing discussions about how to use that money, and there's already been efficiency projects approved, and they're talking about additional ways to use that money and to pay people to either temporarily or permanently use less water. And then there's discussion about how do we make that sustainable. So that was a one-time infusion of federal cash. Can we find ways to have a more sustainable funding source for all these projects? Because in the end, like, money's a big part of it. And like we've been saying, there are ways to use less water. We know how to do it. Often they just cost money. And so we need to figure out how to pay for it, and then figure out not just paying for it, but how to like take advantage of projects when they happen to actually explicitly benefit the environmental conditions below those projects. So it's not just paying people to use less water, it's paying people to use less water and then taking that water and making sure that it does have explicit environmental benefits.
And the bipartisan infrastructure law, that also infused, right, a bit of cash for water infrastructure.
But you get these weird, like, and this is the challenge, you get these weird situations where, like, the Cienega in Mexico is reliant on return flows from an irrigation district. So if they use less water, that very important wetland and bird habitat starts to dry up because there's less return flows from this irrigation district. So that's the Salton Sea. Like, if the Imperial Irrigation District in Southern California, if they suddenly use a ton less water, that's less water flowing in the Salton Sea, and you have huge public health impacts. Some of the highest asthma rates in the country are in the community surrounding Salton Sea. So that's why I was saying earlier, it's not just like a silver bullet, like switch technology and boom, you're good. It's, you have to think about all the aspects of how using less water will play out on the ground. And you have to be very intentional, making sure you don't cause more harm than you're doing.
And then you do have that one extra I was just going to ask real quick, the international layer, right? Because you're getting, you know, federal, state, counties, but then you're also negotiating with Mexico. Has that fluctuated in terms of cooperation or tension, given shifting administrations? Or is there worry that if there's not a new Biden incoming administration, there'll be political knock-on effects on basin management because of that, relationships with Mexico?
In general, the relationship with Mexico, the U.S. and Mexico, is pretty positive. They have found ways to work together. They've updated, they call them minutes. They're minutes to the 1944 treaty that originally gave Mexico its Colorado River allocation. And you might have heard of the pulse flow event that happened in 2014, which is a big glug of water sent down to the Colorado River Delta. And that's all done in negotiations with the U.S. and Mexico. And those are ongoing. And we're hoping that with these new guidelines, or in a parallel process to these new guidelines, we'll have some sort of long-term agreement where Mexico shares in the shortages, but both the U.S. and Mexico are committed to providing those environmental benefits in the Delta region. I will say really quick that, knock on wood, the Colorado River stays below national politics pretty well. And so there was huge concerns in 2016. Like, yeah. What happens? A lot of the rhetoric around, immigration, and was that gonna trickle down and impact U.S.-Mexico relations on water? And it really didn't. And across administrations, it generally doesn't. Although there can be some implications during election years, like if there are swing states, administrations don't want to piss off swing states.
Well, we got to land this ship. So I have a final question. In 20 years, John, will our daughters be able to go fishing in the Colorado River?
So my hope is that in 20 years, our daughters can lead us on Grand Canyon rafting trips, and we have a healthy flowing Colorado River in the Grand Canyon, and they can take us on a multi-week rafting trip to the Grand Canyon. That's my fingers crossed that she's interested in becoming a river guide, and I hope she does, and I hope there's a healthy flowing Colorado River. I'm pretty optimistic because everyone understands that we need to use less water and we need to figure this out and how fundamental the Colorado River is to society in the West. I think we'll be in a spot in 20 years where the conversation won't be over, but I think we'll be moving towards a more sustainable use of the Colorado River, which includes things like environmental flows, in-stream flows, such that our daughters will be able to fish. Because that's one trend, I would say, that we've seen. We talked at the beginning about this, 120-year evolution of the law of the river and how it's managed. And I'd say for most of that, environmental concerns were not included, explicitly ignored, but more and more there's been recognition of the importance of considering environmental flows and environmental values, and that the environmental values are not a monolith. There's different viewpoints within people's concerns about the environment. And so I do think there's more of a conversation, more and more folks are open to that. And I think as part of these new guidelines and ongoing updates to the law of the river, there'll be more incorporation, more consideration of things like environmental values. And so I think we'll land in a spot where we do have pretty healthy and flowing rivers here in the West.
And if all else fails, we'll just go get the icebergs.
Go get the icebergs. They're right up there. They're so close. Like,
just tow them down.
I see some sea ice out my window still.
They looked into giant plastic bags where you just fill up fresh water, and then that will float, that will bob on the sea, and you just tow those down to Southern California. So there are options, people.
Great Lakes Pipeline, Columbia River Pipeline. These are all ideas, right?
All ideas that have been talked about for 60 years and are just as dumb as when they were proposed 60 years ago.
Thanks so much for listening to A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by me, Simona Capizani, and Alex Lee. Our show is produced and edited by Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're subscribed on any or all of your podcast platforms of choice. If you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating. Tell a friend. It really helps us out. Thanks again. See you next time.